everybody, and welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. On January 26, 2005, George Leonard and Michael Murphy appeared in conversation with Marjorie Weingrow, UC Berkeley. George Leonard is the author of 12 books, including Mastery, The Keys to Success in Long-Term Learning, and The Life We Are Given, which he co-authored with Michael Murphy. George was an award-winning senior editor of Look magazine for 17 years. He also holds a fifth-degree black belt in the Japanese martial art Aikido. He is one of the founders of Aikido of Tamalpais, a dojo in Mill Valley, California, where he currently teaches both Aikido and Leonard Energy Training. Michael Murphy is the co-founder of the Esalen Center for Theory and Practice in Big Sur, California. He's also the author of 9 books, both fiction and nonfiction, exploring extraordinary human functions. In 1992, he produced an encyclopedic work, The Future of the Body, which describes thousands of cases in which normal humans have exhibited metanormal functions. In 1991, Murphy and Leonard began the first Integral Transformative Practice Group. ITP, as it is called, is a series of daily practices designed to promote well-being and health and to enable people to realize more of their potential. They describe these practices in The Life We Are Given, a workbook for long-term practice published in 1995. Marjorie Weingrow is the chair of the Sage Scholars, an award-winning mentoring program at UC Berkeley. She organized the evening, which took place in a large utilitarian lecture hall on the university campus.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you tonight. My name is Marjorie Weingrow. I am the director of the Sage Scholars program at UC Berkeley. I'm just thrilled to have with me two friends and people that I admire, who are Michael Murphy and George Leonard, who many of you might have heard about through Esalen. And we'll talk about Esalen for those of you who are a little young and may not have heard of Esalen. And we're also going to talk about ITP. So I'd like to begin and ask George, if you could just tell us a little bit about Esalen first.
Oh my goodness. How can you explain Esalen? It's almost impossible. First of all, it's in one of the most beautiful spots in the world, right on the edge of the sea. Mike, up to you, sir.
Esalen is an educational nonprofit institute. It's been there for 43 years. We do about 500 seminars a year. You could characterize it very briefly as ways to explore more life, personal growth, personal transformation. You've heard all the cliches. In many ways, this kind of enterprise, you know, which is all around us these days, is still searching for a name. Arguably, there's not been a de Tocqueville or a sociologist to describe this whole kind of venture. In any case, about 10,000 people a year come through Esalen. That's the public side of the institute. The other side, to say it very briefly, is we do invitational conferences and promote research projects and social action projects of various kinds. We've been doing those the whole 40 years of the institute. And they range, these programs range from Soviet-American relations. We got very involved with the Soviet cultural exchanges with the Soviets in 1980. And that program really has evolved today. We're starting a new initiative dealing with the problem of religious fundamentalisms, Islamic, Jewish, Christian, Hindu, etc., working with members of the foreign policy establishment from Washington and people from Europe and people from the Middle East, and trying to get at the psychological roots of terrorism and what's behind fundamentalism. So it ranges just briefly from that to we are brokering meetings now with a community that is formed in Europe, started at the Sorbonne, on what they call esoteric studies. Anyway, so this this will go on for 5 or 6 years with this a community of scholars in Europe, meeting American scholars, and just to give a quick overview of how far afield we can go in these kinds of initiatives, we, for 7 years, have been sponsoring a group of people involved in empirical inquiry in the spirit of William James into the question, does something in us survive bodily death, postmortem survival? It's a new look at the whole James agenda that was set out by, say, 1900. But these are all people who are coming at it not in any way as a religious issue, but as a pure empirical issue. And the first book out of that series will be published this fall. So anyway, that gives a quick sketch of the kind of range of stuff that goes on at Esalen.
And if you could just talk about, Esalen became very popular in the 60s. And if you could just drop some names for those who don't know about who came to Esalen.
Well, you should know that Esalen was not founded by Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth. but Fritz Perls, Aldous Huxley, you know, Linus Pauling, Paul Tillich, Carlos Castaneda was a young graduate student when he came for the first time in 1964. And then the University of California Press published his first book in 1969. He was a friend in those years before he became popular. So it was a tremendous gathering place in the 60s. And there was a lot of music, the Beatles and Joan Baez and Simon and Garfunkel. And George, you say something, and let me...
Well, don't forget Arnold Toynbee, who at that time was on the cover of Time magazine. And the great mystery that? About it all is that these people came because Mike wrote them letters. I think he was able somehow to condense his charm into print, just one letter. And they said, yes, we'll come for $200. He was the most famous at that time, on the cover of Time when he came down there, historian in the world. He came to Esalen, paid his own way, and got $200. So there's something magical about the very beginning of Esalen. The basic idea of Esalen is really the human potential.
That's the key.
We don't need to, everybody knows about the hot tubs.
Right.
See, we gotta keep some secrets. George, how did we meet?
How did we meet? Okay, I was working for Look magazine. I worked there for 17 years, and just very briefly, Look was the most honored magazine and with the largest circulation of any big magazine in those days, 34 million readers. And I finally decided, I'd been doing a lot of education coverage, and I began to wonder, are the schools really developing and inculcating the human potential? I said, maybe not. So I turned in a story idea simply to be called The Human Potential. And another thing about Look is the writers and editors and so forth were free to go as many places as you wanted to go, to take as much time as you wanted to. And the whole time I was there in 17 years, I was never asked to change one word because of policy. Now, name a magazine like that today. It's sad, especially the young people who never had a chance to read it. Why did it go out of business? Television advertising. The advertisers off television. But anyway, I had already interviewed 37 experts on the human potential. Brain researchers, psychologists, psychiatrists, philosophers, theologians, everybody you could think of, crisscrossing the country, going back and forth for a period of 5 months. And I'd finished 10,000 words of the article. I was hoping it would be 20,000 words printed in two parts of Look. So I gave the first 10,000 words to a wonderful woman named Lois DeLatra, and we had lunch together, and she said, look, you've got to meet Mike Murphy. After reading this, she said, you've got to meet Michael Murphy. I'd heard of Esalen, a funny little place down on the Big Sur coast. So, and she said, he's coming to my house tonight for dinner, and you're coming too, and you cannot say no. I said, okay, Lois, anything you say. So I walked in there, and there was Mike in the kitchen eating cheese and crackers. Now, this was February the 2nd, 1965, after which my life has never been the same. But we started talking in the kitchen. And very shortly, have you ever had this experience when everyone else sort of faded away? Just the two of us were talking. And we talked there for several hours, and then the party finally ended. Lois had to get to bed finally. So we drifted over to my house on California Street at the time, and we continued talking, I think about 2:30, maybe 3, but it was certainly 2:30. And we decided to join forces, that Esalen had been created under the banner Human Potentialities. Aldous Huxley had that idea. So 2 weeks later, I went down and was introduced to some of the techniques of Esalen. A couple of weeks after that, Mike came up and spent a long weekend at our house, and this went on back and forth, back and forth. We just kept right on meeting with each other, and we've been doing it ever since.
Right till tonight.
That's 40 years, over 40 years. No, it'll be 40 years on the 2nd
next
of February.
Week.
That's right.
40 years next week.
That's right. 40 years next week. So that's how I met Michael Murphy.
So tell us how the two of you got together on your quest around ITP.
Well, I like to start different kinds of programs, and I had also started Aikido. He got me into Aikido, too. Then he dropped out. But the vast majority of people do not stay with Aikido. It's the most difficult of all the martial arts to learn, and Mike had other more important things to do. And
what a pal.
In Aikido, there are all sorts of things that are rather mysterious. How many people have been to one of my workshops where I do the limit energy training? Yeah, you know,
see,
things that would seem counterintuitive that just shouldn't happen. Just like Aikido is very mysterious and shouldn't happen, but does. It's very effective. So I started something called Linnet Energy Training, which was to take the principles of Aikido and use them for workshops. So in the period basically of the from 1976 till when we started ITP, I had presented this to 50,000 people throughout the United States and also Europe. And so it was good, a series of discrete exercises, but it wasn't a program of transformation. You had transformative qualities in it, and the exercises and demonstrations were quite spectacular, but it wasn't ITP. So as the 90s opened, Mike is just finishing up this magnificent work. Oh my God, I can hardly pick it up. It's so heavy. Here it is. The Future of the Body. How many people have read it and looked at it? It's like an encyclopedia. You don't read an encyclopedia page by page like this. You look at what you need to look at. This is one of the great accomplishments of our times. And this was in 1991. This was in galleys, I think. And this had just come out. And look at my puny little book. Compared to this, I mean, my God, there's no comparison. Mastery. But a lot of people seem to love this book and do things like sleep with it or carry it with them at all times. It has something, and I think the main thing it had in it is the idea of long-term practice and the fact that just the quick fix doesn't work. And that's something we learned at Esalen. Because in the early years, in the 50s and 60s, in the 60s when you started, there was the idea that you could go to one weekend and your life would be totally transformed. And it was. It lasted, a weekend lasted, as Mike had figured out, till Tuesday. And a five-day workshop generally lasted about 2 weeks. It was good. Wonderful experiences are good no matter how short they are. We began realizing that it takes long-term, patient, diligent practice, and that's the message of this little book. So I got the idea of let's start a practice, a long-term, diligent, patient practice, which will really help us somehow bring out more of this incredible human potential. In my human potential story, my coverage, and I went out and talked to these 37 people, he was number 38. None of them said that we were using more than 10% of our potential, of our true potential. They were incredibly conservative. After studying this ever since 1965, I don't think it's any question that we're using, really, most of us, about 1 or 2% of our potential. About 1 or 2% of our potential. And we could do it, but we just have the idea here, especially in America, we had the idea that everything can be done very quickly, period, just like that. But so we got the idea of starting, and I started working on it. I started trying to create a series of exercises, which we call the ITP kata, K-A-T-A, a Japanese word meaning form. It's something you go through in the same sequence at all times. And one part of it, one exercise, one part, should lead naturally and gracefully into the next. So in the September of 1991, I started practicing it and doing it with groups whenever I could, changing it around and so forth. So we then put out a call for people who would like to volunteer to be part of our experimental program. Now, to be part of this experimental program, instead of being paid like in most experiments, they had to pay us. It was $65 a month, and we had a very nice group of people. There were 33 in the first group and 30 in the second group. We did it for 2 years. And we also did a sort of a study. And then Mike and I went on to write the book, and ITP continued without us. The Life We Are Given, here it is. And then the subtitle is very important, the long-term program for realizing the potential of mind, body, heart, and soul. It's integral and it's transformative. And so this was published in 1995. And when that was published, we also have now a DVD of the kata, the series of movements. And it's spreading all around America, and also in many other places that are very strange. We get postings from places like Bulgaria or New Zealand, you know, and that's how it started. There's a lot more to say about that. But
yeah, would it be useful to say a little more about the different elements of ITP beside the kata?
I was just trying to keep moving.
Yeah, a little bit about the how you began with the early results. Could you explain about some of the problems that you encountered at the beginning and how you've evolved to what ITP is right now? And then we can go into ITP now.
Well, actually, the problems were rather small, but we did have that homeostasis thing. Any kind of self-organizing system, whether it be a tadpole, or a dog, or a human being, or a whole culture, will resist any change, whether that change be for the bad as well as for the good. So one of the big problems we had, after about 2 or 3 months, people were really beginning to get something out of it. They were seeing their life change. And then at that point, and there was generally some kind of resistance. It just followed that. There's a chapter in both of these books about homeostasis. Our editor of this book insisted we publish We steal from this book, I was plagiarizing myself here, to put that same chapter about homeostasis and the desire to stay in one system. And of course, that's a good thing. We want to keep our temperature the same, our blood pressure about the same. If it suddenly went up to 300, wouldn't be too good. Or down to 30, that wouldn't be too good. So it's a survival thing. But when you want to make a change, you're going to have to make some basic changes. And homeostasis will resist that. So anywhere between 2 months and 4 months, the group would say, well, let's bring in something new and different. That was one of the real problems we had. And groups today still have that problem.
How did you evaluate the success of the program?
Well, we did our own little bit of research. Now, more research has been done, and more will be done, some high-level research. But we did pretty good research, actually. And those results in the back of the book, in the appendix. And people really got tremendous changes out of it. And some of them were rather spectacular. We had spectacular.
How did you evaluate it?
Well, we hired Dean Ornish's statistician. Mm-hmm. And we all did it in official statistics with probabilities and so forth, and got some very good probabilities that the people who most followed the commitments which we made did better in most every aspect of their life, of their training and their practice. And maybe I should just mention the commitments that people make.
That'd be great.
Is that okay?
Good.
All right. Get my glasses. Okay, I'm going to shorten these slightly, but they will get the idea. Number one, there are 8 of these. I take full responsibility for my practice and for all transformations of my body and being that flow from it. But here's a very important second part of that number one. While respecting my teachers and fellow practitioners, I fully understand that I am the final authority. Okay, I have to say right now that we do not particularly in 21st century America feel that the guru is the best teaching model. We are anti-guru. We wanted to have multiple mentors. We wanted to avoid any kind of feeling that I am the way and the life, the only way and the only life. So we said that people are their own authority. 2, I seek to join in community with other ITP practitioners. While maintaining my individual autonomy and authority, I commit myself to my ITP community in vision and practice, etc. 3, I do the ITP kata at least 5 times. I understand that time permitting, I can lengthen any part of the kata, and that extended periods of meditation at the end of the kata and at other times of the day are recommended. And again, these all have chapter references. See chapters 6, 7, and 8. 4, I accomplish at least 2 hours of aerobic exercise every week in increments of no less than 20 minutes. 3 hours a week in increments of no less than 30 minutes are recommended. 3 sessions of strength training a week are also recommended. Okay. 5, I'm conscious of everything I eat. 6, I develop my intellectual powers by reading, writing, and discussion. I thoroughly consider the visions and teachings set forth in chapter 12, and commensurate with my own best judgment, seek to integrate cognitive understanding into my practice. Now, that's sometimes hard to get people to read, you know, anything except Google. Okay. 7, I open my heart to others in love and service. I stay current in expressing my feelings to those close to me and take care of my emotional needs in appropriate and healthy ways, seeking counsel when needed. See chapter 13. Each of these has a reference. 8, and the last one. For each 6 to 12 month period, I make at least 1 affirmation having to do with significant positive change in my own being. I also make the following affirmation. Everybody does this one. My entire being is balanced, vital, and healthy. I include my affirmations during transformative imaging in my kata and seek in appropriate and healthy ways to realize those affirmations, see chapters 4 and 5. And we did find that the people who most followed their commitments got the best results in achieving their affirmations.
So, could you talk about the Stanford study that was done about this?
You want to take that one? I don't know.
Well, you know, the results, this was Stanford University Medical School got a grant from the California Endowment for $500,000 to study 3 groups of people over 55 following this program for a year each, and studying changes in their cognitive abilities, the physical health and capacity, and psychological well-being. So actually, the numbers are still being crunched. So that's the status of it.
Okay, do you know when
they will soon be out?
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you.
We are taking drastic steps to get them out.
Great.
Yeah, we've been very disappointed how slow they've been.
So tell us about what's going on with ITP recently. What things are going on now?
Well, George has said, you know, there are groups springing up. It's spreading.
Yes.
We have lots of plans afoot. It might be better, George, for you to talk about this. It's important to say this is all nonprofit. Mm-hmm. We're not a for-profit entity in any way, and none of us gets any salaries, nothing like that. It's in the interest of this work to keep spreading it. We are thinking about forming a 501c3 that will bring a lot of this work together and facilitate it.
Well, we've been offered a rather handsome donation, which means that we can do a lot of things we haven't been doing before.
Yeah.
So actually we're in a period of great growth, a kind of a upward curve that's happening right now.
And could you talk about how it affects people's stress level?
Well, certainly you should. It should show us better ways to handle stress. Just the balancing and centering that you have in the kata. Mm-hmm. If you really do the kata every day, life will automatically be better. Or even if you do it once a week, it'll be better.
Right.
So, and that's just a part of it. You also, affirmations are a very important part of this. And one of the harder things to teach, because as most of you know, that during the, from the 60s on, there have been a lot of affirmations and the idea of resolutions and so forth. And most of them don't work. And so we spent a long time working out a method of affirmation that really does work. You can see all that in the book. It's really very clear.
I think at this point, it would be a really great idea to have a sample of ITP. I see a lot of heads shaking. So could you give us a sample?
Would you all like a little of that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's just do one of the simpler things, which is just balancing and centering, just that. So would everybody stand up?
In this section, George will lead the audience in a balancing and centering exercise. Your feet are placed shoulder-width apart. When the direction comes to raise your arms, raise them in front of you to shoulder height, palms facing outward. In the last part of the exercise, you begin a gentle turning motion with your hips, turning from one side to the other and allowing your arms to relax totally and swing loosely with the hip motion.
Okay. How does everybody feel? Make a sound. You're already in pretty good shape. We'll see you again. Okay, just stand here like about this far apart and take your hands or just one couple of fingers and touch yourself. Press it in about 2 inches below the navel. Okay, now breathe into that spot instead of way up here. Breathe deep down into that spot. Relaxing, easy. Okay, bring your hands up about this far and begin shaking them out till your whole body vibrates. A little harder, a little harder. Let them drop. As soon as they touch your leg, as you breathe in, just float up as if they're in warm, salty water. And then straight forward. Okay, move them around and just see if you can make a connection with anything in the room. Another person. Yeah, don't take too long. Just relaxing, breathing, easy. We're going to come to the front again. Let your hands drop down. As soon as they touch you, it's automatically with the incoming breath, they go up again, floating up. Once again, just check it out. Check out our surroundings. Okay, just put them down and stay down. Please close your eyes. Okay. Check now to see if your weight is evenly balanced on the right and the left foot. This will entail shifting very slightly, right and left. Eyes closed. Very nice. Now see if the heels and the balls of the feet are balanced, the same amount of pressure, soles of your feet, forward and back, just slightly. Very nice. Okay, take your head and just move it back and forth and forward and anyway, and find the place where it balances with the least effort, with eyes closed, if possible. Of course, you're the authority at all times. You can do anything you want to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, while you're doing this, check and see if everything on your face is totally relaxed. Your forehead, how's your forehead? Just let go any tension in the forehead. Cheekbones, jaw, chin, all of that. All right, now with a sharp, hard incoming breath, raise and tighten your shoulders. Way up, close to your ears, tight, 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 tight. Relax your shoulders. And feel that same relaxation moving down. Down the arms, the forearms, the hands, the fingers. Relaxing. Shoulders even more relaxed. Rib cage, just letting it go. Heart, lungs, diaphragm. All the way to the abdomen. Going down, down, down. Don't forget the back half of the body now. Relax all of your back, all the way down. Feel that warming sensation as you really relax, moving downward. Becoming aware of the floor, warming your feet, and your feet, the soles of your feet, warming the floor. As you breathe in through the nose, through the nostrils. Open the mouth slightly and exhale through the mouth, as if you're blowing a small ball of cotton. When all the breath is out, very gently close your lips and just wait, expecting nothing. The incoming breath will come of its own accord, of its own accord. Breathe in through the nostrils. Open the mouth very slightly. Exhale. When all the air is out, simply close your lips very gently and just wait. You don't have to do it. Isn't that wonderful? The incoming breath will come on its own. As you're doing this, become more aware of the back half of the body. We so often ignore that, our desire to get ahead. But on the next incoming breath, let your eyes open and yet stay what we call soft. In other words, look at nothing particular. Don't look at anything in particular, but see everything. Looking at nothing, seeing everything. And just let, again, this kind of motion begin. Let's be gentle. The breath is automatic, no problem, don't even think about it. Eyes soft, eyes soft. Every time you do this, at every turn, you become more and more relaxed and more centered. Awareness in the feet, the soles of the feet, warming the surface beneath them, the surface beneath them, warming the soles of your feet. If you'd like to make a little sound, go right ahead. What if I said that we'd do this for the rest of the program? It'll be a very advanced program, very advanced. But right now, we'll let this slowly stop. And if you so desire, please be seated. Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you. I think at this time, it might be a good place to open up for some questions. I'll repeat the questions for recording purposes. Question was, how is your work similar to other practices like EST or beliefs in Buddhism and so forth? Is that okay?
Well, lots of connections. First, the kata that George developed includes certain Aikido moves. I mean, just this, Tai Chi, some Hatha Yoga, Edmund Jacobson's progressive relaxation, if you know that. And then the basic attitude of mindfulness that has been so central to Buddhist practice. Now you take ITP as a whole, and we conceived it out of this big, 40-year symposium at Esalen, where all these different practices came flowing in. And that book, The Future of the Body, was my attempt to make sense of, what do all these different practices have in common? And so a lot of what we drew upon, it happened deliberately out of our own past. For example, again, George, I think, was the main influence on how ITP does affirmations. And there's been a lot about affirmations in everything from Alcoholics Anonymous to various forms of cognitive psychology, reframing. How do you look again at one of your problems in a new way to reframe it conceptually? And all of that has kind of flowed into making affirmations. But also, I would say it has a lot in common with taking vows in Buddhist practice. Vow taking is fundamental, really, in nearly all transformative practices. But in some, it's kind of just implicit. It's not lifted up and framed, so to speak. So in ITP, it's a deliberate framing of affirmations. And we could, spend the rest of the time just talking how that's done. So I would say we drew a lot, George, on the whole notion of the synergy of practices, that very often when you put two practices together in the right way, you get 2 + 2 = 5. For example, if you get anybody up on a treadmill, these studies were done by Herb Benson at Harvard. You take anybody who has not done a lot of working out. You get up on a treadmill, and you can tell what your workload is. Any of you have gotten up on a treadmill, you can do so much. So the experiment they ran was, all right, you do that. Then they come back before they've done any training. And the second time you get up on the treadmill, you're instructed that when you're running, you repeat the mantra. In the case of Herb Benson, when he started doing it, just one. Just say one, one, one. Well, it's quite remarkable how your workload capacity goes right up without any fitness training. So that the principle there is you put your mind where your body is. Now, if any of you watched Tiger Woods this weekend win, how many of you watched that tournament with Tiger Woods? Anybody? Any other golf nuts here beside me? Wow, that's interesting, not a single person. this is, well, anyway, this a wonderful commentator, Nick Faldo. He's, sometimes I just think the English talk better than we do as Americans. But anyway, he has this beautiful cultured voice, and he was examining Tiger Woods shot by shot. Here comes this marvelous, marvelous athlete, and commenting that at times Tiger was taking a practice swing one way, but visualizing his shot another way, because these golfers picture it. And he actually, on the last hole, called it. He said, he is going to whiff this shot. He's practicing this way, and he wants to do this, and he did. And it was a kind of dramatic moment, this unpredictable moment. Now, again, the principle, putting your mind where your body is. So this synergy, now this can be repeated in many, many ways through the practice. If you put together, no matter how much you do it during a day or during a week, a physical practice of some kind, some sort of fitness, we have emphasized fitness training and strength training and so forth, with staying current in your emotional life in some sort of community, which is very, very helpful and necessary, I think, for most of us, with a some sort of, you know, opening up to the vision of that is implicit in the in this practice, thinking about it, reflecting, drawing on intellectual resources and source. So anyway, this synergy really is again 2 + 2 = 5. So in that sense, we drew on one of the most ancient principles in transformative practice. If you do, you know, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it's an integral practice. It starts with the moral precepts, and there's physical practices. There's it's arguably weak on interpersonal, psychodynamic stuff. We could discuss this, but in those days, you know, when these yoga systems emerged, this was 2,500 years before Freud. So the modern world has brought a lot of new understanding into play. Also, however, it's lost a lot of what ancient cultures knew about the contemplative depths and the powers and the ecstasies that can emerge in the contemplative life. But anyway, so we're trying to draw on both the ancient and the modern and put it together. So there are a lot of influences. That's a short answer.
Well, you got the glasses. I want to
just take
a little riff on this. Wherever we had sources, we put those in there. Now, the kata, we have this section on the benefits of it. Each exercise flows into the next naturally with no feeling of haste. I like to think of it as a piece of music in 7 movements. And the movements go together too. But you can trace its lineage, this is in the section on the kata, to Hatha yoga, the martial arts, modern exercise physiology, progressive relaxation, visualization research, and witness meditation. It offers practitioners the following benefits. Balances and centers the body and psyche, provides a generalized warm-up, speeding the heartbeat, increasing the flow of blood, and sending an infusion of heat to all parts of the body. Articulates practically every joint in the body. I haven't found any joint that it doesn't. I just don't want to make claims here. But that's something we're particularly proud of. It's an articulation series where you articulate things that you might not have done for a long time. Enhancing the lubrication of the synovial joints makes available a comprehensive course of stretches, increasing flexibility in all major muscle groups. Includes 3 essential strength exercises, provides a full set of progressive relaxation exercises in which muscle groups are tightened and allowed to relax deeply. Those are done lying down. Presents numerous opportunities for deep rhythmic breathing. Includes a period devoted to transformational imaging during which the powers of intentionality can be applied to making positive changes in body and psyche. Concludes with 10 minutes of meditation. Now, all that can be done in 40 minutes without hurrying. However, we recommend, if you want to keep it going, especially meditation, we get into a meditative state where you have those physiological and psychological changes which Herb Benson has called the relaxation response. They begin happening when you're lying on your back doing your deep relaxation and when you're doing your affirmations, your imaging. And by the time you start meditating, you've already really, in a sense, been meditating for 10 minutes or so. It seems to be something that's very, very useful for people.
Where does the integral come in? Are there different modalities that it refers to?
Just mind, body, heart, and soul, that everything is integral. Now, Mike, this book came out in 1991, 1992. the last three chapters in this book are quite amazing. One of them is the basic principles of integral training, integral practice, and of transformational practice. And they inform me a lot, and maybe the little book and some of the things I've done out of Aikido inform Mike. So it really blended together on the thing. And we credit all of that. Certainly Aikido has had a big thing to do with it. But that book, that's the Bible.
Well, you know, the integral idea, I mean, the shorthand we use is body, mind, heart, and soul. It's just saying to engage, to consciously engage our various aspects of human nature, both, you know, within, let's say, our psyche and in community and with others. So that's the basic idea. There's two aspects to the integral, I think, this comes up. And, you know, that word integral, by the way, it's had a long history in Western philosophy. In Russia, for example, it was huge in Russian philosophy before the revolution. And then during the Soviet era, Tselnaya Lichnos, the integral personality. But it's a double-edged sword. There's integral in the sense of including. And then there's integral in the sense of integrating. But it's in the service of more life. It's not, this is an interesting question, it's not highly normative, you know, that there is an exact way to be. And I would just say temperamentally, George and I are, you know, we've been through either directly or indirectly an awful lot of cults. To be involved with Esalen, I often feel like, you know, Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, if you remember, you know, there to catch people when they come out of cults, yeah. Where you have this drive, whether it's dictated by the teacher or not, of a kind of cloning. And eventually, that means a conflict somewhere. So how do you form a community of practice that honors uniqueness, kind of, and radical autonomy, and promotes more life, and yet integration at the same time? And that's, you know, that was kind of in the founding of Esalen, that was fundamental, and it's been fundamental to us in ITP, if I'm making sense. So maybe this is not in your mind, but a lot of